Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we take complex, transformative ideas and give you the ultimate shortcut to understanding them. We cut through the noise, synthesize the knowledge, and deliver the aha moments directly to you. Today, we're undertaking a deep dive into a cultural and spiritual artifact, Ram Dass's classic, Be Here Now. This book is legendary not just for its content, but for its power to fundamentally shift how Westerners approach inner peace.
And our mission for you is to distill the core answer to a persistent human question. How do we find lasting happiness and profound peace when our world is built on distraction, mental clutter, and, you know, constant striving?
It's striking how relevant this 1970s text is right now. I mean, we live in a state of perpetual digital distraction, don't we?
Absolutely. Information overload, anxiety is rampant, and even with material abundance, there's this kind of pervasive spiritual exhaustion people feel.
Yeah, exactly. That exhaustion.
What Ram Dass offers is a radical antidote, the present moment. He argues that the peace and freedom we seek are only accessible now. That's it, because that's the only place reality actually exists.
So today we'll synthesize his incredible journey from this really skeptical academic to a beloved guide and distill his practical methods for presence, which he calls sadhana.
Sadhana. Spiritual practice.
Okay, let's start with the author's background, because the story of Dr. Richard Alpert becoming Ram Dass is, well, it's arguably the most powerful part of the book itself.
It really is.
We're talking about a man who had already achieved the absolute pinnacle of Western success. He had a PhD from Stanford, a tenured professorship at Harvard University. Pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, the whole package. And that's the ultimate spiritual paradox, isn't it? Alpert had everything the ego could possibly want. Wealth, status, prestige, institutional power.
Everything on the checklist.
Right. Yet underneath all that worldly achievement, the sources make it clear he felt this gnawing spiritual void, a profound sense of alienation. He was, you know, successful but deeply unfulfilled.
And that deep personal yearning led him and his colleague, Dr. Timothy Leary, into some pioneering, though highly controversial research.
Very controversial.
Yeah, looking into consciousness and psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin back in the early 1960s.
And while that research definitely came from a genuine spiritual hunger, it resulted in a really critical realization for Alpert.
Which was?
That the chemically induced states, they provided these profound glimpses of unity, of consciousness beyond the ego, but they were temporary, always temporary.
Ah, okay, so the effect wore off.
Exactly. He describes coming down and returning right back to his ordinary neurotic, you know, ego-driven self, the same old patterns.
The psychedelics were like a powerful preview. They showed him there was a door to liberation, maybe?
That's a great way to put it. Showed him the door, but didn't give him the key to keep it open.
Right. That distinction feels crucial.
It is. It meant the real work had to be internal, something sustainable. And that fueled his quest for something permanent, which eventually led him to India in 1967.
Okay, India. This is where things really shift, right?
This is where his entire scientific rationalist worldview just. It came crashing down. He met his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, often called Maharaji.
And the stories from that meeting are incredible.
They are. Ram Dass recounts how the guru demonstrated this extraordinary insight, like seeing right past his carefully constructed academic ego, knowing specific, sensitive details about his inner life.
Things he couldn't possibly know.
Things like details about his mother's death, even his recent LSD use back in America. Things that just shattered Alpert's scientific skepticism.
Wow. That kind of unconditional love, maybe, mixed with that undeniable knowing, that must have been earth-shattering for a Harvard professor.
Completely. In that encounter, Richard Alpert, the psychologist, essentially dissolved, and Ram Dass, which means servant of God, was born.
And that transformation, that journey, is what makes his teachings so powerful, so authoritative for us in the West, right? Because he walked that bridge.
Precisely. He walked the bridge from rigorous science to, well, heartfelt spirituality. He gets both worlds.
Okay, let's move into the book itself. Be Here Now. It isn't structured like a typical book, is it? It feels more like an experience.
It's definitely an experience. Section 1 is the biography we just touched on, our story that really establishes the why. Why this whole spiritual journey is necessary in the first place.
That's the stage.
Exactly. Then we get to the legendary section 2. From Bindu to Ojas. These are the famous brown pages. This is the core philosophy of the book.
And they look completely different. Rough paper, collages, illustrations, little sayings.
Right. It's all very intentional. Printed on this rough, recycled paper using collages, illustrations, aphorisms, deliberately avoiding standard linear text.
Why do that? It feels like it's designed to kind of bypass the analytical brain, maybe. The part that just wants to dissect everything.
You nailed it. It's meant to sidestep the analytical linear mind, the same mind, by the way, that trapped Richard Alpert in his own success story. It's designed to speak directly to intuition.
Okay, intuition. And the title itself, From Bindu to Ojas. What does that signify?
Well, it gives us a clue about the journey. Bindu refers to a subtle point of concentrated energy or consciousness, often related to the mind, the starting point, maybe. Ojas is more like the end state, spiritual vitality, power, deep health, that inner radiance.
Ah, I see. So the book details how to transform that ordinary mind stuff into something more spiritually potent.
That's a good way to think about it, transforming mind stuff into spiritual essence.
So that brings us to the core concepts from those brown pages. Ram Dass hammers home this idea, the illusion of time. What's that about?
He basically says the mind is like a time-traveling machine. It's constantly trapped, right? Either analyzing past regrets, replaying things, or projecting future anxieties, worrying about what's next.
And that's where the suffering comes from, being stuck in the past or future.
Yes, from clinging to those times that don't actually exist right now. The only reality, he insists, is the eternal now. So if you want freedom, you have to learn to disengage from that constant mental time travel.
Which leads to the central practice he teaches, the witness consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain that? How do you cultivate that awareness?
It means learning to observe your thoughts, your emotions, your physical sensations, like an outside observer, neutral, non-judgmental, without getting pulled into the drama of it all.
Not identifying as the thought or feeling.
Exactly. This awareness, this witness, he says, is the true self. The Atman, the eternal, unchanging soul, which is totally distinct from the passing moods and thoughts of the ego. So when the mind screams, I am angry, the witness just notices, ah, there is the phenomenon of anger arising.
That sounds like, well, a huge liberation, just creating that space.
It is. It's profound.
But Ram Dass also talks quite a bit about karma, that it sometimes feels like this heavy force of consequence. How does that fit into just being here now?
Yeah, that's a common question. He reframes karma really beautifully, actually. It's not some kind of divine punishment system.
Yeah.
It's simply the natural law of cause and effect. Think of it like spiritual physics. It provides the necessary curriculum for our spiritual evolution.
Yeah.
Every challenge, every difficult person, every single situation is precisely what we need to encounter to burn off our egoic attachments, our illusions.
Wow. Okay. So it shifts it from feeling like a victim of circumstance to seeing it as intentional learning. Like, this is my lesson right now.
Exactly. It's grist for the mill, as he says. And this whole philosophy, this way of seeing things, is really encapsulated in that beautiful idea he shares. We are all just walking each other home.
Hmm. That really highlights our fundamental interconnectedness, doesn't it?
It does. And it naturally leads us out of just the philosophy and into action. If the brown pages are the what, then section 3, called Cookbook for a Sacred Life, is the practical how.
The how-to section.
Right. This grounds all that abstract philosophy right into our daily lives.
This is where he talks about sadhana, right? Spiritual practice. He offers concrete recipes, things we can actually do.
Yeah, practices like hatha yoga, not just for exercise, but for purifying the body and mind. Pranayama, conscious breathing techniques to calm and stabilize the nervous system, and various forms of meditation, like repeating a mantra, even guidance on diet, favoring simple, pure, or sattvic foods.
What's the crucial insight here? Is it about setting aside special time for these?
Well, yes and no. The really crucial takeaway is that the spiritual path is not separate from your everyday life. It's not something you only do on a retreat or in a cave.
Okay.
Ram Dass insists that every single action, no matter how mundane, waiting in line at the store, sitting in traffic, washing the dishes, can be transformed into sadhana. By doing it with full, non-judgmental presence, by being totally there while you're doing it, instead of lost in thought about something else.
That's huge. That means we don't have to quit our jobs or leave our families to find peace. It's available right here.
Right here, right now.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, let's pivot then. Let's synthesize some of the key themes for you, the listener. The ultimate takeaway is we can maybe apply immediately. Theme one seems to be this radical reframing of suffering.
Yes. This is one of the most powerful concepts in the book, I think. Ram Dass calls pain grist for the mill, or sometimes the sandpaper of our incarnation.
Sandpaper. I like that image.
Right. It implies it's not something to be avoided or eliminated at all costs. It's actually the necessary friction. It's what smooths the rough edges of the ego and shows us exactly where we're still clinging to illusions, where we're still caught.
So embrace the sandpaper. Okay, what's the second major theme? The role of the guru. like Maharaji. It's clearly important, but the book makes it clear this isn't about blind obedience or worship, right?
Absolutely not. The guru fundamentally is a mirror. That's the key function. Yes. They reflect back to you your own inner divinity, your own potential. And crucially, they also reflect your egoic blockages, the places you're stuck. Maharaji offered this profound, unconditional love, and it was that love, that total acceptance, that allowed Ram Dass's intellectual ego to finally relax and start to dissolve.
So the guru helps you see yourself more clearly.
Exactly. And the underlying message is that the perfect guidance, the real guru, ultimately resides within you. The outer guru just helps you find the inner one.
And the third theme, the ultimate reality he keeps pointing towards, it seems to be love. With a capital L, maybe.
Yes. He argues that the primary illusion of the ego is separation, me versus you, us versus them. Awakening, therefore, is realizing the fundamental unity, the interconnectedness of all being.
We're all one.
Pretty much. And when you truly realize that unity, selfless action naturally follows.
Which is seva.
That action is seva, or selfless service. It becomes the natural, effortless outflow of recognizing that we are all parts of the same whole. You serve others because, on a deeper level, they are you. There's no real separation.
That's beautiful. Let's pull out a couple of memorable ideas, sort of like mental anchors you can grab onto quickly. The idea of inner silence, for instance.
Oh, yeah, that's encapsulated in the line. The quieter you become, the more you can hear.
Simple but profound.
Right. Our constant internal chatter, the mental noise, it's like a massive distraction machine. If we want to access our deepest intuition, our inner wisdom, we have to consciously create the space for silence. We have to turn down the volume inside.
I also love the tree analogy he uses for self-acceptance. It's so visual.
It really is. He points out, you look at a forest, right? And every tree is different. Some are bent, some crooked, some tall, some short. And you never look at a bent tree and think, ugh, that tree is wrong. It shouldn't be like that.
No, you just accept it as it is. It's just a tree.
Exactly. But we apply this merciless judgment to ourselves until every human we encounter constantly. He shouldn't be like that. I shouldn't feel this way.
So Ram Dass calls for that same unconditional acceptance towards ourselves and others.
Yes, to just allow ourselves and other people to simply be with all our bends and quirks, just as we allow nature to be itself. It's a radical call for compassion.
And maybe the most direct tool he offers, something you can use in the moment, is that identity mantra, I am loving awareness.
Yeah, that's like a spiritual first aid kit.
Yeah.
Use that whenever you feel trapped by a limiting definition of yourself. Instead of getting lost in, I am stressed, or I am anxious, or I am a failure.
You just repeat.
You just gently affirm, I am loving awareness.
Yeah.
It's like a little cheat code for shifting your identity away from the temporary thought or feeling back to the spacious, aware consciousness that is your true, unchanging self.
Okay, so we have these profound ideas,
yep.
But let's get practical. How do we apply this stuff when we're just, you know, drowning in emails or scrolling through social media? Give us some specific actionable tips. How can you use this right now?
Okay, tip one, mindfulness in mundane tasks. Seriously, pick something you do every day without thinking, washing your hands, waiting for the kettle to boil, walking to your car, and just for that minute or two, bring your full attention to the actual sensory experience. Feel the warm water on your hands. Hear the sound the kettle makes. Feel your feet hitting the pavement. Instead of mentally rehearsing your next meeting,
you're just there.
You're just there. It transforms moments of stressful waiting or boring routine into little pockets of peaceful presence throughout your day.
That makes the day feel less like just rushing between things and more like actually inhabiting the moments.
Really like that.
What about dealing with difficult emotions? Like anger or frustration.
Right. Tip two, emotional regulation through conscious witnessing. When a strong emotion hits fear, jealousy, frustration, whatever it is, try not to react immediately on autopilot.
Easier said than done sometimes.
Oh, for sure. It takes practice. But try using that witness perspective. Silently say to yourself, oh, there's frustration arising in me. Or, okay, jealousy is present right now.
Just naming it.
Just naming it and observing it as if you're watching a cloud pass in the sky. That simple act of naming and observing creates this crucial little gap, like an inch of space, between you, the calm witness, and the overwhelming feeling. It gives you a choice before you react.
That space is everything. Okay, and tip three, maybe something for anxiety, which is so pervasive.
Yes, the perfect antidote for our modern age. Dismantling anxiety by grounding in the now. Remember, anxiety is almost always future-based fear, right? It's usually a story, a fictitious narrative about what might happen, what could go wrong.
The what ifs.
Exactly, the endless what ifs. So when your mind starts spinning those tales, you have to gently but firmly bring your focus back to physical reality, right here, right now.
How? Like literally?
Literally.
Yeah.
Focus on the sensation of your breath going in and out. Feel the physical contact of your feet on the ground. Notice the feeling of the chair supporting you. Anchor yourself in the present moment, because in this precise instant, the vast majority of those projected fears, they simply don't exist. They're just thoughts.
Grounding in the physical present dissolves the future fear. Got it.
That's the practice.
You know, reflecting on this whole thing, what was truly astonishing for me personally was the sheer scale of Richard Alpert's transformation. That someone who reached the absolute peak of Western scientific thought, the Harvard pinnacle, would willingly surrender his entire identity, his framework, based on the wisdom he found with one man in India.
It's a powerful testament.
It really proves that the deep yearning for spiritual truth, for meaning, it transcends every academic label, every intellectual boundary we put up.
Mm-hmm. And that leads perfectly, I think, to the final sticky thought for you, the listener, to carry forward from this deep dive. The lasting message of Be Here Now is really this. The freedom, the peace, the joy we so desperately seek. It's not hidden in some distant future goal or some amazing achievement or even some altered state of consciousness.
It's not out there somewhere.
It's not out there. It is fully and completely available right here in every single moment. If only we can learn to relax the ego's constant striving, its endless wanting, and simply be. Just be present. The goal isn't actually to get somewhere else. It's to fully wake up to where you already are.
And the surprising result of that awakening, as you mentioned, isn't necessarily withdrawal from the world, but actually deeper engagement through action.
Exactly. That realization of unity, of interconnectedness, it naturally flows into selfless service as the most authentic expression of love and compassion for all beings because you recognize yourself in them.
A powerful place to end. Thank you.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.